Radio St. Pete presents Typewriter Talks with Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit.
Hello, welcome to Typewriter Talks. This podcast features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. My name is Maureen McDowell, and I am the founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. On Typewriter Talks, we discuss all kinds of writerly topics, hoping to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Typewriter Talks began in April 2020 and ran through March 2021 in response to COVID as an online chat that spanned 39 episodes, which can be found on our Keep St. Pete Lit YouTube channel. After taking a break to regroup, we decided to return as a podcast. Today, we are happy to welcome Peter Kagiyama. Peter is the author of 4 nonfiction books, For the Love of Cities, The Love Affair Between People and Their Places, and the follow-ups, Love Where You Live, Creating Emotionally Engaging Places, and The Emotional Infrastructure of Places. At the beginning of this year, he released his first work of fiction, Hunter's Point. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Maureen.
It's nice to talk to you again. We did an interview at Tombolo Books during your big book release at the beginning of the year.
Yes, and thank you again for that.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. It was fun. I loved reading your book and I always love like getting inside the brains of writers that I know. I wanted to know why the switch to fiction from nonfiction.
If you'd asked me, before COVID or even like the first half of COVID, I usually describe myself historically as a speaker who occasionally wrote, but COVID obviously changed a lot of things for a lot of people. And I had this intense time of being home. I finished the 10-year anniversary edition of For the Love of Cities, and I was still sort of in this writing mode, and I didn't kind of know what to do with that energy. And I'd read a book that really inspired me and kind of got me thinking about this historic backdrop. And I quietly began working on this book. I didn't tell anybody for a while until I finally, released about 4 chapters to my wife and said, hey, what do you think about this? But yeah, I'm going to call this a silver lining in that otherwise dark COVID cloud there. So thank you, COVID, for that.
Yeah, I also talk about the gifts. I often talk about the gifts of COVID. It really kind of got us quiet where we've been on this treadmill for so long, and kind of to be introspective and recalibrate our lives and think about what we need. And for you, you were like, I think I'm a fiction writer. And this is a series of books, correct? This is the first of a series?
Yes. And in fact, the sequel is done. It's with the editors right now. And looking up book 3. So yeah, I've unleashed the beast apparently. So I loved it. I always enjoyed writing. I think I knew that. But I really loved working on this different side of my brain or something like that. So yeah, it's been wonderful.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book, or you want people to pick it up? Yeah, go ahead.
I'd love to, to pick it up, but here's the gist of it. It is, it's historic fiction. It's set in San Francisco in the late 1950s. The main character is a Japanese American. He was an internee, and he was also a soldier during World War II. And now he is a private detective for, a lot of folks who don't historically get a lot of attention from, traditional private detectives, sort of the outsiders, the underdogs who need somebody to help them. He's the go-to guy for that sort of community. And this story revolves around an area of San Francisco that not a whole lot of people know about. It's called Bayview Heights. And there's a naval base out there called Hunter's Point, which is where we take the name from. And there's some very interesting and some shady things going on at Hunter's Point there that leads us to, Cold War politics. And there's a backdrop of the beat poetry scene, which I thought was really kind of fascinating to write about. There's some interesting cameos as well. Jimmy Stewart, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, to name drop a few, I guess I should say. it's a fast-paced adventure. With some historical stuff that really happened at that time, and some personally historic stuff there as well, because I base some of these characters on my own family and my family's experience during both during and after the war.
Well, I mentioned to you when we spoke at Tombow Books about how I love that sometimes we have books written by men that it's pretty much all about a man's journey, but you really brought in all these different types of characters, including his, well, I won't give it away, but I feel that the women are very well represented in the book. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I guess it's always, that's a compliment. If men can write good women, good female characters, I guess that that's saying something. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So you just finished your second book in this series. Mm-hmm. So what are you working on right now?
Well, it's sort of, we're finishing up the editing on book two. Actually finishing up the audio version of Hunter's Point will be out probably within the next 3 weeks. I'm reviewing the final things on that. That's a whole other world that's been really interesting as well. And I'm super excited about it because it was like, oh my God, this is like, this guy brought my words to life. He did a fantastic job with that. And so it's like, I feel like I'm juggling like three stories. I'm juggling the first book, obviously, the second book, which is with the editors. And I'm still now I'm thinking about the third book. It's like, this is kind of nuts, but.
Welcome to the life of a writer.
Yeah, apparently. So this is what I guess I'm signing up for. But yeah.
So how did you, if you don't mind saying, how did you find the person to do the audiobook or?
I went through a company who sort of packages the whole thing together. So they, they produce it. They, you know, they help me source the actors and then they'll get me into the proper distribution channels. It's sort of a one-shop stop, which I kind of appreciated. Some people said to me, it's like, hey, you got a nice voice. You should read it. It's like, well, that's very kind of you to say that, but I am not an actor. And the thing is yeah. like, if I was reading, you know, my nonfiction stuff, I think absolutely I should, you know, I should be the one who reads that. But good audiobooks, those people are actors. They really do. They bring a story to life. You know, all these different characters and the voices. It's like, no, know what you're good at. And, you know, I don't think that's my strength. So we got to, you know, the company, we put out the word, you know, for auditions. I got to review like 10 different, you know, actors for this stuff. And they were all very, very good and narrowed it down to two. And we sent back some notes. They came back and got one guy. Actually, he's a Chinese American guy out of Los Angeles. And he's like an actor. He's got an IMDb reel. So, you know, I probably will see him on some, you know, Law and Order SVU episode or something like that. Holy crap, that's Theo. It's like, yeah, that's my guy. Yeah, it was really interesting to go through this process.
Yeah, your book had a very strong, what would it be? I was going to say filmatic, but that's not a word.
Cinematic.
cinematic.
Yes.
That's funny. Sometimes I make words up. Why not?
Okay.
But what, cinematic what quality.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has a very strong cinematic quality. Like I saw it as if a movie was. I had asked you who you want to have cast as the main characters when we talked.
I've got that in my head too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't know any other way to write. I guess, you know, I'm seeing this story sort of evolve and I'm seeing it almost as a picture in my own head. And I guess I'm chronicling that there. And I'm also, you know, I love movies. And so, you know, a good story, you know, like that seem, you know, seems that it's visually oriented, the pacing, on something like that. I've not been doing this that long, but I can't imagine not writing in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I mean, you need to write how you're meant to write. Like I think sometimes new writers, which you're not technically a new writer, but you're in a new genre, they tend to think that they have to do it the way that everyone else is doing it. Or they look at what's popular right now or whatnot. But I think following what is your best path is always the right way. And it may be sometimes you're ahead of the curve, you know, this new way of.
Yeah.
And so many books now are being adapted to series.
I would totally
why not
love that.
Think like and that. I
can see it as a limited series. I think it's, you know, hey, Netflix, if you're out there listening, give me a call.
Yeah. And it's funny because I just saw Daisy Jones and the Six. I watched the series.
Loved it.
And then now I'm reading the book.
Okay.
And then I saw the series of Normal People, and now I'm reading the book. So it's interesting. Sometimes it can lead you
Yeah.
to the book, even though the series. So it's like an interesting flip almost. But it
Yeah.
so I fingers crossed for you. Fingers
Well,
crossed for you.
there's a lot of great stories out there. But yeah, it'd be nice to at least, somebody, yeah, it'd be cool. Let me just put it out there to the universe. It would be very, very cool. I'd be very grateful. Thank you.
Well, it's also like I just started watching the series Beef, and
Okay.
there is more Asian stories coming onto television, more
Yeah.
representation happening. So you're right in it. You're right
Well,
in the, you know, not that you, that's why you're doing it, but this story, it was time for it to be told. But
no.
I think that seeing a character like Cats is like
Yes.
really needed right now, and just so fascinating and interesting, and
Yeah.
especially in the book. It's not giving too
Well,
much away how he also represents people that are not necessarily represented, or, you know, he works
yeah.
for people as a private eye that aren't usually, you know, helped. So I love that part of the book. So,
Well,
oh, go
thanks.
ahead.
No, representation matters. And you say that, and it's like now you're seeing, Asian American or Asian stories up there. We had an Academy Award winning film.
I know.
That's
Yeah.
awesome. And only,
And two Academy Award winners.
yes. But when I was a kid growing up, there was almost no Asian representation on television. And that kind of matters. We had Mr. Sulu. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
And then as I grew up a little bit later, it's like, hey, Bruce Lee. It's like, oh my God, Bruce Lee exists. This is amazing. There. But it's taken a while, but I think hey, there's lots of voices out there that are finally starting to get enough some attention, and that's a good thing.
That is always a good thing. So tell us about your writing process.
Years ago when I was first thinking about my very first book, this would be, in the late aughts, there. I read Stephen King's book On Writing, which I cannot say enough good things about. It's a memoir, but it's a master craftsman telling you sort of how he does it in a very accessible sort of way. And the best advice that he put in there, and I remembered this, I still remember this. This is what I tell folks. He said, writers are readers. He says, if you don't have time to read, you don't have time to write, which is an interesting thing because, well, shouldn't I be focused on this? And I've come to realize that my time reading, and when I'm in that writing mode, I make sure every morning I get up and I'm reading something. It could be, fiction, nonfiction. It could be part of the research I'm doing there. But to me, reading feels like fuel for writing. It's like, I'm reading somebody else's stuff, and I'm, either I'm getting inspired, or I'm going, I can do better than that. Or it's like, oh, this is really cool. It's like I need to have some elements like this, something, but it feels like fuel to me. And when I'm going, it's like I'm not prescriptive about saying, oh, you got to do, 2,000 words, you got to do this. It's like I'm conscious of how many words, I'll produce in a day. I usually, when I finally wrap up, I look and see, it's like, how many did we do today? Oh, 600. And that's a good, but okay, we're getting there. Or hey, 2,600. It's like, hey, this is a good day.
Yeah.
But I'm not slavish to a word count, there. And some days it comes a lot easier, some days it doesn't. It's a little more challenging. But honestly, I used to like to work in the coffee shops, and I still do, but I
Yeah.
found that I'm actually getting better at working at home. But I have to, it's certain places at home. I like sitting outside on my porch.
Yeah.
I get a great view, and I put in headphones just so it's enough sort of, background music, background noise. And yeah, I can write at home now, which was something a year or so, a couple of years ago, I always said, that's impossible. I need a coffee shop. But yeah. And I do try to get right every day when I'm in that sort of writing mode. Right now, like I said, I'm sort of scattered. I feel very discombobulated by all these different things that are sort of pulling my attention. But when I'm working on the book every day, yes.
I love that. How's your writing process changed over the years? Because as you said, you used to, was that
Yeah.
because of COVID that you moved, you know, out of the coffee shops and been
No,
working from
because
home
well,
or?
even during sort of COVID, there was a couple of coffee shops where you could sit outside or sit there. It's like I still
In
felt like
Florida. In Florida, let's be
in
clear.
Florida. That's right, we're in Florida. There. No, I think my process has changed because the stuff that I was doing before, my nonfiction work is like you know, I'm looking for, there's certainly more research. There's more stuff, places I've gone, places I've seen. It's like, I'm trying to sort of, you know, paint a picture of this really cool project, you know, in Richmond, Virginia, or in Akron, Ohio, or something like that, and trying to convey why that's important. So there's a different sort of mindset in this, but all of this stuff, you know, this, the fiction is like, this is an internal dialogue, you know, there. It's like, certainly I'm doing research, but I'm doing research of a time period or something like that. Or how does this work? Or how does that work there? But it's, you know, it feels far more internal, I guess would be the best way to put it, than the work I'd done before. So that is different. And it definitely feels different.
Yeah. So there would be a need for quieter spaces. And
Maybe that's it. Yeah. It's funny. I also found that as I got closer to the end of the second book, I wanted to write at night. I don't know why, but sun would go down. I'd sit on the porch there nighttime, and it just felt like, okay, we're sort of like in the, and it was the, you know, granted the end of the story does take place at night, so maybe that was part of it, but it just felt appropriate, you know?
Or maybe it's like the psychological winding down the book and winding down the day.
Sure. That's a very good analysis. I will go with that. There. And again, you know, in the past that was never sort of, you know, the issue. It's like, it wasn't my own psychology wasn't sort of part of the process, but I think clearly as, you know, writing fiction, your psychology is part of that process. And that's kind of interesting because they don't tell you that in the books. There's like,
no.
Hey. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny, but I think it's also good to, you're really showing how there's not one right way to be a writer. And then sometimes even in the span of a life of a writer, your writing process changes, and we can get so fixed that this is how we are and we can't do anything differently. And then maybe you decide that you need more privacy, or that you want to work at night, or maybe you have a child like I did, and I went from writing for several hours a day to, okay, I've got enough time for the length of this DVD. This is before streaming services.
Yes.
And we'd pop a DVD in an hour and a half, pop in the DVD, the kid's occupied, this is my time. And then I pretty much stuck with that time period. Sometimes it'll go a little longer, but it seems like an hour and a half is pretty good for me. So. Have you always been a writer? Oh, well, you want to say something?
No. That's a better question. No, like I said, I would have probably, you know, said I was a speaker who occasionally wrote, you know, four books in the space of about 10 years is not exactly Stephen King, you know, there. But and I think I was a storyteller because when I would present, you know, my bread and butter really has been, and I guess continues to be, I'm a speaker. I go and I tell stories about, you know, I work with cities on making them better, better placemaking, better communities, all that kind of stuff. And I tell stories around that. And so the books were essentially just sort of these compilations of these stories wrapped around sort of like, why, you know, so how does this matter? Why are downtowns important? Why is parks and green space? How are we doing this? How are we doing that? So it didn't feel, it's writing, but it didn't feel, I guess, the same way, you know, in all of that. So, I would not, like I said, a speaker who occasionally wrote. Now I'm embracing this idea as like, yeah, I am a writer, and I kind of love it.
That's, yeah, I can't think of a better life, I'll be honest. It's not an easy life necessarily, but I can't imagine not being a writer. Like, it's just...
Yeah,
it's like, as long, I just pray, like, as I age, that my brain stays in my hand, you know,
yes.
But, you know, like, because I write by hand mostly, like that.
Oh,
I
really?
Stay.
Okay.
But then I also voice to text. So I guess I could move to that. But just the fact that, like, let me keep my faculties, because I could just sit in a chair and continue to churn books out and be happy as can be. So
that sounds like a pretty good life. I agree.
I know, right? It really is. So I have a question, that what would you tell your younger writer self? But like, what would you have told yourself, the you that was just starting out as a fiction writer, from the place you are now? What advice would you give
all
yourself?
Of like 2 years ago?
Well, we change a lot, right? If some cells are regenerating every day, so you
we
are
do.
A new person.
Yes. I think it's the process, you know, the fiction, you know, in the past, it's like I wrote, you know, these nonfiction books, like they sort of validated my, I guess, expertise as an urbanist, Okay, that's great. If they sold, that's nice. You know, and people would buy them at the events that I would speak at. It's like, this is great. Now it's like the book is the thing. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd probably tell my, you know, past self, not my recent past self, it's like, this is different. And there is a whole other world that you're stepping into around, you know, promoting a book, selling a book, talking about a book. We're talking about a book now. So it's like writing is just part of that. So if you're trying to have your work get noticed, there's a lot of other work that goes into around that that is absolutely not writing, and sort of be prepared for that.
Be
patient with that. You know,
yeah, nothing, that's a good word.
Everything comes in inches, right?
Mm-hmm. So we're such a flash in the pan, like we need success right now. And some people don't even see it until four or five books in. And then I was just listening to a podcast about Cheryl Strayed, who wrote Wild, and when the book came out in 2012, but her another book that she wrote, Tiny Beautiful Things, came out the same year. And now it's Tiny Beautiful Things. Like, Wild was this huge success. Reese Witherspoon played her character in a movie. And like, she had like this huge amount of success came from that. But then Tiny Beautiful Things was basically just like ignored. And then now it's been picked up, and it's a series that just came out on Hulu. And it's like 10 years later that this book is getting the recognition that it had, because the other one kind of overshadowed it. But it's just interesting. Like, sometimes the time for a book is not, sometimes it's not even an author's lifetime, but you know, it takes a while for sometimes for things to catch on, or, you know, some of these, like, even with, we're having a lot of challenged books right now and banned books in Florida. And now everybody's reading Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye because it's been banned. And I'm like, you're getting these, you're getting kids to read because you're telling them not to do this.
That's right.
You think you're doing the right thing here. Like, don't do this, but you're not allowed to do this. And they're like, ooh, I really want to do this. So it's interesting.
I think the real tragedy is, as you said, if it's not in that, in, you know, the author's lifetime, if you don't see that, a little bit of that, if not success, at least that appreciation. Is the Swedish writer Stieg Larsson, the girl with the dragon tattoo, and
he literally
delivered the novels to his publisher and like died of a heart attack. It was like, oh my God. And then so he saw none of that success. And I think it's not even the success would be great. I think it's just the appreciation that your story is out there and people loved it. You know, that's tragic.
Well, I will tell you that I loved your book, so you got your appreciation. So there's a little bit to start with, but I know you already know this. People have been really responding, all different types of people, which is another really wonderful thing.
That is also a difference. Like, yes, people will come up and tell you, it's like, hey, your book, you know, is really cool, or, you know, we're doing this there. But they, you know, that when they talk about characters resonating with them, it's like, oh, I love cats. I love Molly. It's like, oh, this is so fun. Like, that's a different sort of critique or a different sort of feedback than I got with my nonfiction stuff. And it's been pretty cool. So,
tell us, like, maybe, what are you reading right now, or who are you, some of your favorite authors?
I'm sort of like all over the place right now. I've read a couple things that were sort of, research for what I think is the third book, Robert Edsel, The Monuments Men. About the World War II guys who basically saved all of the art, you know, the went after the Nazi art thieves. Like, I think that this may be a backdrop for book three. Not entirely settled on that, but it's a great story. It reads, you know, like, and, you know, they made a movie about, you know, all of that. I've been reading several of those hard case fiction books, sort of. And historically, I wasn't really into that kind of stuff, but I kind of have come to appreciate some of that. Stephen King's written some stuff in there. A woman by the name of Christina Faust, I just finished a book by her. Really quite good. And then some fantasy stuff. Kings of the Wild, this awesome D&D rock and roll fantasy book. Like, okay.
I love it.
Yeah. Like I said, reading feels like fuel. And it's like, all right, let's take on, you know, sort of a steady diet of one thing, I think, is probably not necessarily good for your imagination. right?
Yeah, I definitely read across genres. I primarily read nonfiction, but I throw in some fiction there and then poetry. And then I mean, I still consider sometimes listening to podcasts to me feels like you're hearing somebody read something to
Oh,
you. And
absolutely.
yeah, like all, like that's another form of nourishment and a way of taking in
Well, I'm
new
also
things.
finding, yeah. I'm also finding that, you know, I'm reading something, a physical book, I'm reading something on my Kindle, and I'm listening to something at the same time, three, like usually two or three different things out there. 'Cause some things I want to, you know, to some things I kind of want to read. I want to take notes, especially the nonfiction stuff. If it's research, it feels like you kind of need to be able to take, you know, notes or highlights at least, you know, in the Kindle
Yeah.
app. But there's
Yeah.
other stuff. It's like, I want to go for a walk and I want to be entertained, you know, so you go and that feels very different as well. So an audio version of that feels appropriate in all
So
that.
these are things that, like, if you're feeling blocked, these are ways that you get inspiration. Is there any other ways that you go for anything you do for inspiration other than just not just reading, other than reading?
I don't want to jinx it, but I've never really felt blocked.
I love it.
I've felt, you know, it's like, I need to work on this. It's like, you know, and you just feel like there's something sort of churning. It's like, all right, I'm stuck on this particular thing. How do I get these characters from here to there? Or how do I solve, or how does this sort of thing happen? And sometimes you just got to, like I said, you go for a walk, you go for a workout, you watch something else on TV, you read something, and you're, you know, sort of that the, you know, the in the back of your brain is still trying to solve this problem, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, and then it comes like, oh, what if we did this? And it's like, okay, and then we're off and running again. So I don't necessarily
Yeah.
feel like I don't feel blocked. I feel like it's like, you know, I'm still thinking about it. Does that make sense?
I was talking to Gloria Munoz, who the podcast for her just came out today. We're recording this a week prior to when it will be
Yeah.
aired. And she was talking about that, how we were talking about how when you're a writer, you're always writing, even if you're just daydreaming, like staring off at a wall.
Yeah.
Like it can look like you're doing nothing. It
That's
can look
right.
like you're doing nothing, but we're
Yeah.
not doing nothing. We're churning and
Right.
processing. And I also like that, you know, you mentioned patience earlier and just
Yes.
waiting for life to show you what the next answer is, like through
Yeah.
movies or this. And I've often found if I ever have a major question, I'll pick up a book and like within like a couple chapters, the answer will appear right there for me.
It's like
So that's
magic. Yes.
It's like magic, but it's also a dance. Like if
Yeah.
I would say the older I get, the more I'm like, okay, I need to just go do this and or go listen to this band or go see this, and then all of a sudden the muse
Yeah.
whispers and then I get the answer I need. So okay,
I will
so
say
go
music is
ahead.
important too. Music, I think, you know, sets a mood and a tone and whatnot. I listen to music while I'm writing, and I actually have a sort of a playlist of songs that I never have to like. It's like, I don't really want to listen to that right now. So like stuff I love, but it could be like all across different genres and whatnot. Some of it's completely instrumental, some of it's like very rock and roll. But it's something that it's like I don't have to hit, you know, it's like skip. I never have to do that. So it's, yeah, that I think is important. You know, if you have something, you know, that maybe is, you know, fueling you in that way that you never have to stop and think about. Does that make
It's
sense?
interesting. Yeah, but it's interesting that you're able to do that because I could not. My child's like that. I'll come into his room and he'll be
Yeah.
like watching a document, a film, and then texting with his friend, and he's drawing on his tablet the most amazing piece of digital art. And he's also like doing his homework. And I'm like,
Yeah.
how are you doing all three of these things like at the same time? But
Yeah.
he's doing them all well. He's not just kind of, you know, the homework. He's getting straight A's.
Yeah.
And I'm like somebody that, like, if I'm writing, I need to be. I mean, maybe I could have some instrumental music in the background, but
Yeah.
if I hear the words,
Well,
it'd be hard for me to do. So that's really interesting how different we all are, right?
I think we live in a world of, someone phrased it this way, we live in a world of continual partial attention. We're
Yeah.
always dividing our attention between different things. And some of us, you know, are more comfortable with that than others. Clearly you know, your son has developed that. Because I think kids today have been sort of born into a world that's just like that. That to them is normal. Well, I remember when there were three, you know, stations on television.
I know,
And,
yes,
you know,
ABC,
there.
CBS, and NBC.
Yeah. And you had to go to the TV to change the channel.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think, you know, I have adapted to something like that, but I get it that, you know, not everybody's built that way. It's like, that's fine.
Yep. That's why be you, be you. All right. So you have a piece of writing to share with us.
I do. So,
all right.
This was, let's see here. All right. I'm sorry. Okay, here we go. So this scene takes place. Katz has gone to see his friend who he met on the set of Vertigo, one Jimmy Stewart. And I don't know if people knew this, but Jimmy Stewart was actually in the Air Force during World War II and was an active, you know, maintained an active commission in the Air Force and well into like the late 60s into the early 70s. In fact, he becomes a brigadier general at some point. So Katz is enlisted Jimmy's help in all this. And so Stewart has some information, and Katz has gone down to see him at his home in Hollywood. So here we go. They sat down on a comfortable bench that looked like that looked at the small pond near the rear of the garden. Katz recognized that this was the price for Stewart to share his secrets. He wanted to be sure who he was giving them to. Katz drew a deep breath, feeling the need to center himself before sharing the story. I should say Stewart has asked for the Katz's story about how he won the Silver Star during World War II. So yes, it was the Vosges, just after the battle in a town called Biefontaine. We'd fought house to house against some tough German resistance, but they had taken the city. Our guys were exhausted, but 2 days later, we were ordered back into action to relieve a battalion of Texans that had been cut off by the Germans. "The lost battalion," said Stewart. Katz nodded. "Those guys have been surrounded for days by the Germans, and no one could get them out. We tried airdropping food and munitions to them, but those mostly ended up in the hands of the Germans. Hitler had apparently made the destruction of this battalion a priority among his generals, so the stakes were high. They sent us in, and I was part of the advanced scouts looking for ways to flank the Germans, but they were deeply entrenched into the mountainside." He looked across at the placid scene in front of him, so at odds with the death and chaos of his memories, but he continued. "Eventually, we were pinned down in foxholes and behind trees, even though the Germans were just yards above us. Command ordered a charge, and like a bunch of crazy samurai, we attacked up the hill screaming, 'Banzai!' at the top of our lungs." He paused. "We lost so many men." Stewart watched his friend, not wanting to press. He gently put a hand on Katz's shoulder and waited for him to continue. "I found myself up the hill, a bit ahead of the rest of the squad. I could see the concealed bunker that was spitting out machine gun fire. I was out of grenades, so I had no choice but to dive into one of the openings and take the fight to the men inside." Stewart shook his head. "How many men were in there?" Katz looked at his hands. "They said there was a dozen." "You were injured?" "Shot. Twice." Stewart nodded and knew better than to congratulate or compliment his friend. Those who'd not been to war might marvel at the bravery, the so-called heroics, but soldiers knew better. He squeezed his friend's shoulder, and they sat quietly for a time. So that was a little interlude between Katz and Jimmy Stewart there as two soldiers, men who'd been in combat there. But Stewart had done some research for Katz and was about to reveal some secret stuff that he probably shouldn't have, but because he respected Katz and he knew what kind of man he was, he was willing to do it. And so, yeah, that was an interesting sort of scene to write. It was not the action. It was not this, but it felt interesting to write between my fictional creation and this Jimmy Stewart, who is, you know, one of America's great, you know, iconic actors. Everyone knows, you know, him and his voice. So it's like you can picture this interesting conversation between the two of them.
And and also I didn't realize that Jimmy Stewart was actually still a part of the military.
He was.
While he was acting. Yeah, yeah. And you let us know more about that in the book too. Well, Peter, thank you so much. And you've been a wonderful guest, and it's been great to interview you again. And I feel like we covered all new territory again.
Well, so. Congratulations on bringing Typewriter Talks back. Well done.
Oh, yeah. So exciting. Yes. It's a little bit, I was telling a friend today that it's a little bit of me getting a masterclass too by interviewing all these writers, being a writer myself. So there's a little bit of selfishness, but that's okay.
That's okay. Enlightened self-interest. Okay. Well done.
So thank you. So thank you everyone for tuning in on episode 2 of Typewriter Talks. This series will continue weekly. And if you want to know more about Keep St. Pete Lit, you can go to keepstpetelit.org. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Typewriter Talks features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. It is hosted by Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. Listen in to hear discussions on all kinds of writerly topics. Our goal is to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Learn more about Keep St. Pete Lit at www.keepstpetelit.org.